Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of the Pro Football Weekly Podcast. My name is Dan Mott, and I am your host for this week's show. We have Hub Arkish in the studio with us this week, changing things up a little bit as we give Arthur the week off. Hub, how are things?
Things are good. Actually, one of my grandsons is having a minor medical procedure this afternoon. Everybody's fine, doing well. This is the newbie. This is Theo. And so I thought I should spring his dad and let him go be of support to both mom and son, as well as another one of my grandsons, Spencer, who I'm sure is anxious about his brother's procedure.
Well, we hope everything is going well with Arthur and the family. And
By the way, minor stuff, all good. The baby is great. This is just something that you fix young because it hurts a lot more when you do it old.
And we have Eric Edholm joining us as well on the line this week. Eric, how's things?
Yeah, great. You know, and Hub, I've been there myself, so I'm feeling for Theo. I know it won't hurt him as much as it will mom and dad. Our daughter had hernia surgery when she was about 10 weeks old, and we were out there sweating, and she was probably fine. So everything will go fine, and we can't wait to hear about it.
I got to tell you guys a quick story as long as we're there. I don't think anybody else wants to hear it, but I got to tell it. Another one of my grandsons, they messed up the circumcision. And again, not life-threatening, not horrible, but they're going to have to go back on that one at about 5 or 6. And I'm already in pain. So,
all right, I'm sweating over here.
Yeah, fortunately, all my grandkids are doing great, and we are blessed. And this is just it's the way life goes, folks. There's stuff you got to take care of.
All right, guys. Well, we have a packed show for you this week. We'll be taking a look around the AFC North as we continue our division-by-division breakdown over the next few weeks, and we'll talk about the floors and ceilings of each team. Plus, we have some big news this week, guys, and we're going to start that with the way we hear it.
It's time now for The Way We Hear It.
The biggest headline this week being the national anthem policy, which league owners passed at Wednesday's owners' meetings in Atlanta. Hub, let's just start by talking about what this policy is and what does it mean for the league.
Well, you know, guys, we've got to be pretty clear with our listeners on this, and I think with a podcast, it's probably a little safer and more acceptable to occasionally inject some personal opinions or thoughts. But because we do all work for Shaw Media, and I'm kind of the editorial voice here, we're just not going to take a position on what's right or wrong here, okay? You've got two arguments. Players should be allowed to protest freedom of speech, blah, blah, blah. The other side, nobody, should protest during the anthem. It's disrespectful. I'm not going to pretend to have a right or wrong answer to that. What strikes me about this is, given a very difficult problem, because the league in some respects is in the same position that we are, not wanting to offend anybody, I talked about this on The Score in Chicago the other day. I can't escape the thought, Eric, that Roger Goodell gathered all of his minions around him, all of his lieutenants, all of his assistants, sat him down in a conference room and said, okay, we've got this problem with the national anthem. How can we screw it up worse? And I think they absolutely succeeded. The players, I think, are disappointed in not being supported by the owners and the new challenges they face, because they're going to try and work around this and find new ways to upstage this unfortunate decision that takes away their freedom of speech. Again, I'm not saying right or wrong. That's how I think the players are going to react. But what was so disappointing to me is that in the process, Goodell clearly threw the players under the bus. I mean, he said in his statement, it was unfortunate that people took the player protest last year as disrespectful to the flag, because that clearly was not their intention. And then he instituted rules that said, but if you do it again, you're going to be punished severely. And what's even worse than that is that in saying what those rules are, they specified not standing for the anthem and left out everything else and said that's going to be up to Goodell. And so the biggest problem they had, unrelated to the national anthem, with the players and the Players Association, was the all-powerful Roger Goodell, the lack of due process, his ability to rule whatever he wants, whenever he wants. And now they've created a whole new category of those rulings, and it's going to start on week one when the first few players push the envelope here, and it's just going to create that much more of a chasm between management and labor.
Yeah, I mean, somehow the NFL felt pressure, felt compelled to enact this rule, to have this, what they claimed was going to be a clear-cut rule, although, as you pointed out, there's so many vagaries and interpretations here. We don't know exactly if a player stands with his arms locked with his teammate, or, you know, Martha Firestone Ford standing on the sideline locking players with their arms, technically that, as some owners were suggesting yesterday, is considered an offensive gesture. I mean, again, this is just getting so wild and so far from what the original discussion was. So, yeah, by the end of last season, we were not talking about anthem protests. We, you know, there were a handful, a tiny minority of players who were engaging in this. The conversation was on its way out, I felt. Again, no matter what side of it you were on, the owners brought it back in. They lit a match to this fire. They reinvigorated some players' beliefs that we're never going to have that compromise with the owners. So whether you feel like this was pressure felt from, you know, the Department of Defense money they get for the salute to service stuff, whether you felt like this was a couple of rogue owners sort of flexing their muscles and inflicting their will, or whether you're believing that this is just a precursor to how the owners want to push around the union when labor negotiations come up in 2 years, whatever your thought is on those, it just felt unnecessary. You know, I don't know. It just felt like they tried on one hand appease both sides, you know, butter both sides of the bread. On the other, they felt like they were kind of making a mandate here. So it's just an odd discussion that we're having right now.
You know, guys, what it really feels like is that, and let's just call this what it is, it was a minor topic of discussion until Donald Trump decided to jump in.
Mm-hmm.
And my sense here is that what they tried to do is what I'm guessing the DOJ is trying to do with Trump, with this whole thing of you know, briefings for first the Republicans and then the Gang of Eight and whatever. They know what the briefings are going to show, so they kind of cut them off at the pass. I think the owners tried to do the same thing. I think they knew if they didn't do something that Trump was going to jump in and cause more problems for him. So they tried to appease him, which they clearly have done, because now he and Pence have both weighed in. But they left an opening for the players to go ahead and continue to protest. Now the problem is that they got to decide how they're going to punish them, because they said they would when they do protest. And as you just said, I mean, what is disrespectful to the flag about 53 teammates linking arms and standing at attention for the national anthem? There's nothing disrespectful about that. And yet, as you just said, apparently some of the owners think that's going to be one of the things that they get punished for.
Yeah, and if they do, that really does open Pandora's box. I mean, you know, had let's put it this way, had in 2015, before Colin Kaepernick started this whole thing, you know, if somebody had done that, linked arms with their teammates, it would have probably been seen as a, you know, compassionate gesture or a brotherly gesture, or however you want to say. I mean, that's where I think this is, you know, we're defining what is and what isn't patriotism. And we're sort of shoving it down people's throats. And I'm a patriotic guy. If I was on a sideline, I would stand for it. That doesn't mean I can't also say that sort of defining what is and isn't patriotism, you know, it gets into some really kind of scary area here. And I talked to some players yesterday. I texted some. I talked to some on the phone. And I think they're just confused by this whole thing. And they were already thinking about ways they could circumvent the rule that they wouldn't normally have thought of had this rule not been put in place. So it just doesn't – there are a lot of angles to the story, and very few of them make sense to me.
Well, and you know, it's really interesting, Eric, because what we get – I don't know what's going to happen with a podcast, but when you're writing, when you're on radio or TV, you get – and it's a minority, but you get some of the audience, stick to sports. Well, we didn't choose this topic, okay? We're not talking about this because we want to make a point or I want to tell you my beliefs. But it's hard to talk about it without sharing some beliefs. And when people talk about, you know, being a true independent, I mean, I've been around a long time. I've been voting for a long time. I have never punched a straight Democratic or straight Republican ticket in my life. And I feel it would never occur to me, no matter what I was upset about, not to stand, and I don't know about attention, I wasn't in the service, and that's one of my great regrets, but standing pretty close to attention with my hand on my heart. That's how I do it, okay? And that's how I personally think everybody should. But what is more offensive to me than somebody not doing that is the fact that it is against the law to punish someone for burning a flag in this country, but we're going to punish him for kneeling during the playing of the national anthem for reasons that have nothing to do with the national anthem? I mean, this shouldn't be as complicated as it is, but it clearly is because of the polarization of political beliefs in this country right now. And the league had a chance to step up and say, let's do something to bring everybody together. And instead, I think they made it even more polarizing.
Yeah, I think, you know, you look at the NBA, I mean, you know, they had this policy for years now, I believe, and I can't remember exactly when it was enacted, but you know, their guidelines are you stand at attention for the, you know, you for the anthem. And they're not facing those same discussions in the NBA. And some people have said, hey, the NBA is a more progressive league. You know, there's all these different things happening there. And yet that's not even a topic of debate there. So obviously, had the NFL done this years ago, that, you know, 2009, they introduced the players on the sideline. They're going to have the anthem play. This is a new thing then. Had they just done it at the time, we probably wouldn't be here. Again, that's also avoiding the conversation here, which is what you brought up. So, you know, I think they came in with this sort of half-hearted, you know, kind of trying to sort of make it seem like a compromise. You know, well, you can go in the locker room if you want. You can go out there. But if you do, it just doesn't feel like a very tidy solution in any way possible.
Yeah, Eric, I had an interesting exchange midweek with Sam Acho, who's the player rep of the Chicago Bears. And this is a really great young man and a really bright young man. And he went out of his way to try and point out that everybody is having the wrong conversation. We had these protests last year. They raised awareness. What we should all be focused on right now is what are we doing to make the problem better? And he said, listen, you know, I have a great relationship with George McCaskey, who's the owner of this team. Am I disappointed that he voted for this new rule? I don't know. I don't want to make a big an issue out of it because George McCaskey is going out in the community with me to try and improve some of the things that we're trying to raise awareness of. And Acho kept turning the conversation back to what are we all doing in the community to make things better? The protest shouldn't be the issue. It's the things that we are protesting. And so I think one thing we can say that has nothing to do with the owners, because I think they screwed this up badly, but from the player perspective, they would be better served to take a page from Sam Acho's book and focus on what they're doing to make things better, not focus on complaints about how they're going to be able to protest in an apparent attempt to bring awareness to things that need to be made better.
It's hard enough to bring, you know, 1,500, 2,000 players together on the same page, but then to do so as well with 32 teams and then the different ownership groups, it's good. It's hard because we've gotten farther away from that, I think. And you're right. And I have all, you know, the respect in the world for players like Sam Acho, who do incredible work, especially his work over in Africa and everything. I mean, those are the guys that we need to put up on a mantle and say, follow his lead and we can get this done. We can come closer to a solution to finding issues in our communities, in the country, abroad. And that's really, I think, what the goal should be.
Yeah, just real quick to maybe put a wrap on this. I know Sam pretty well. I think it's fair to say we're friendly. And we had an interesting exchange in the middle of this media gangbang or whatever it was. And folks, gangbang, that's not a slang term. That's what we call it in the media, when 40 or 50 of us are trying to get close to one guy to ask questions. And Sam wanted to be clear that the conversation was about how much good work all of his teammates are doing in the community, not just him. And it was the kind of leadership that I think we'd like to see, you know, with every team. And he made his point. And I think this is something that fans need to consider when you look at, you know, take a step back, go for the 30,000-foot view. They're not all. A lot of them are doing nothing. A lot of them aren't protesting at all. Some that are protesting are paying it lip service and don't do anything beyond that. But there are a big percentage of these young men that are getting out in their communities and doing a ton of great work that we never hear about, that they don't want publicized. And I think that if you want to be critical of them for wanting their freedom of speech, you have to at least give them credit for everything they're trying to do to back it up.
All right, guys, as I said in the top of the show, we are continuing our division-by-division breakdown and talking about some of the potential for each team and where they might need improvements. This week, we're going to take a look at the AFC North, starting with the Baltimore Ravens, and Eric at home is going to be kind of heading things up for us here. Other than Dez Bryant not catching passes for them this season, Eric, what are we seeing from this team for 2018?
Yeah, this was a group that really got hurt hard by injuries on both sides of the ball last year. You lose people like Marshall Yanda. That's a big blow. And then, you know, the losses have kind of continued in the offseason. Ryan Jensen, a young center, really broke out. He goes in free agency to Tampa Bay. So I think you start with the offensive line and say, hey, is that group going to be good? I mean, they have some players up there, but they have to get much better health than a year ago. Of course, the big story, though, is how they handle the quarterback position. You know, Joe Flacco's handled it for so long, and you draft Lamar Jackson. I think they have a plan for him. I think it's going to involve him seeing the field, not as a starter, but as a a contributor of some sort, a change-up guy at quarterback. We saw it with Michael Vick almost a decade ago, his first year back, and when he was with the Philadelphia Eagles. So, you know, you put that with what could be a good run game. They've added some receivers. I don't know how great Crabtree and Snead and those guys are going to be. They drafted a couple guys, but there's at least a little hope for some excitement offensively. You put it with a good defense and some great special teams, and you know, I think people look past the Ravens a little bit. They're kind of an easy team to forget. I know the fans there had kind of tuned out by the end of last year, but you know, they were on the verge of a playoff berth before blowing that game in Week 17 against the Bengals. I say don't sleep on this team. They were playing pretty darn well down the stretch, even with the tough loss on New Year's Eve.
Well, and Eric, you had an article on ProFootballWeekly.com a few weeks ago about Ozzie Newsome and sort of leaving the Ravens in good shape with his final draft. I mean, do you feel like Newsome really set this up well?
Yeah, their first two picks. I mean, I'm a big fan of Hayden Hurst, the tight end. He was the first selection, followed by Jackson. I thought both of those were really nice picks. And you know, Hurst can't be overlooked. They drafted Mark Andrews, another tight end in round three. He can't be overlooked. They took, you know, Orlando Brown, who a lot of people were saying before that disastrous combine was maybe a first round prospect. They get him in round three. So a lot of help on the offensive side of the ball, a couple wide receivers in the mid rounds, Jahlil Scott, Jordan Lasley. You know, we'll see if either of those guys can stick. You know, the defense didn't get as much help, but I don't think it needed it either. As long as, you know, you still get something out of Terrell Suggs, as long as, you know, Brandon Williams is there, C.J. Mosley, good secondary. I still feel like the pieces are there. And you know, Ozzie's team building had – his reputation probably took a little bit of a hit because the Ravens have missed the playoffs more than they've made it in the last 4 or 5 years. But, you know, this is still a roster that I think is in a lot better shape than many other teams. So I still kind of file them in that very intriguing category. They could be a 10 or 11 win team, and it wouldn't stun me.
With Kenneth Dixon coming back, I mean, where do you think he can make sort of a big impact with this team?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, obviously Alex Collins was the guy down the stretch last year, and he looked really good. But he's got that running style that may kind of open him up to some injuries and stuff. And Dixon, I mean, you know, between injuries and suspensions, he's been a frustrating player. You know, a guy that everybody really liked coming out of college, had some great potential, has faced a lot of blocks. And right now, I would say that Buck Allen is probably ahead of him on the depth chart. But if you can have Dixon, Allen, and Collins, there might be some overlap to their game a little bit, but that's a pretty good trio. You know, I know that's 2 fourth-round picks, and, you know, and maybe Collins. I don't remember exactly where Collins went in the draft, but, you know, a little later. And so, okay, the pedigree isn't all that high, but I think those guys at their best could be a pretty decent little trio. But Dixon's got to prove himself accountable and reliable.
What's the one thing you think fans have to look forward to overall with this season?
For the first time in a long time, there's at least some quarterback intrigue. You know, even when Tyrod Taylor was there, nobody knew who the guy was. It wasn't until he left Baltimore that people learned what he could do in the NFL. So with Lamar Jackson here and, you know, Joe Flacco kind of reaching that point in his career where his production has leveled off, the big plays aren't there, it's not all on him, but there's some frustration with, you know, his lack of improvement. You know, the injury last year certainly frightened some people too. Jackson's going to come in there and provide such a vastly different look. I think that they're going to find a way to give him a series or two per game at quarterback. Now, maybe there's a trick play where he lines up elsewhere, but I think this is really the precursor for 2019, where Jackson can get his feet wet, add some big playability, push Flacco a little bit, and we figure out, hey, does Flacco have another season beyond this one as the Ravens' starting quarterback?
We shift gears now, Eric, and let's talk a little bit about Cincinnati Bengals, which is our next team in our division by division breakdown in and around the AFC North. And let's start with this offense. What is sort of the thing that they need to do to be ready for the 2018 season?
Yeah, Dan, I mean, I think the biggest thing, obviously, I mean, like Flacco in Baltimore, Andy Dalton has leveled off a little bit. I mean, obviously hasn't been there as long and all that. But, and you know, the same reasons. I mean, it's not all his fault. You've got A.J. Green. Other than that, and there have been a lot of question marks on that offense. But to me, the blocking up front is where you start. Now, they go get Cordy Glenn. That's a big upgrade. They draft Billy Price in week one. I mean, in round one. Is he going to be ready for the start of the season? They certainly hope so and believe so. But, you know, I would say the other three offensive line spots have to be questioned, whether they're viable and whether they have solutions up front. Because, you know, you spend second-round picks on Gio Bernard and Joe Mixon, and, you know, you spend a fourth-round pick on Mark Walton. Those are good talents at running back. Do they have room to run? I mean, do they have room to operate? I just don't know yet. Until we see that offensive line perform, it's really hard to say. And outside of Green, I mean, unless you're counting on Tyler Eifert being fully healthy with no issues, and that's been a big stretch the last couple of years, his long history of injuries, I don't know where the big plays are going to come from. I think you have to hope that the run game is kind of the anchor and that Green provides the big plays. Eifert can maybe work in the middle of the field, and, you know, the guy who replaced him, Tyler Kroft, was pretty good, but there's just a lot of guesswork going on offensively, and they just don't know if all these guys are going to be ready to perform and kind of take them to another level.
Well, and you can see that this offense definitely feels that urgency in their OTAs, and they're showing it already here in week two of OTAs.
Yeah, I mean, I think sort of finding that offensive identity is really going to be the biggest thing for them to, you know, find out what kind of team are we? Are we that, you know, play action offense where it's run, hit the big one to Green? Is that going to help Andy Dalton out a little bit? Can any other receiver really step up? You know, I mean, they've got Brandon LaFell. He's fine. They've got Tyler Boyd, who's been, you know, a little bit disappointing, I would say, to this point in his career. John Ross has to provide something of that big play option, too. They draft him with a 9th pick. Barely saw the field last year, mostly coach's decision, too, after he got hurt a little early on. So, you know, that to me is sort of the blueprint. I think that play-action offense is what they're going to try to work on this offseason and kind of make their bread and butter, I think.
Shifting a little bit to the defense, the suspension that Burfecht had placed on him, how does this affect that side of the ball for this team?
Yeah, they drafted Malik Jefferson from Texas in round 3, and he was a player who, you know, maybe has some limitations athletically a little bit, but was a pretty good two-down player in college at times. I think he'll help, and they can always slide Preston Brown over into Burfecht's spot if they need. So is it the best personnel we've ever seen at that spot? Probably not, but, you know, they're also kind of making Carl Lawson, who's a defensive end by trade, into a linebacker. I think that's a really interesting move. I don't know if it's the right move, but, you know, I think we're going to see a lot more nickel from them and a lot more dime packages where let's highlight the pass rush, which is pretty good. You know, Geno Atkins, Carlos Dunlap, they drafted a couple guys, Sam Hubbard. And the secondary, William Jackson was a former first rounder who really broke out last year after a poor rookie season. They've got a couple veteran safeties they like. Drake Kirkpatrick's pretty good. So, you know, I feel like the secondary and the pass rush have to be kind of the real meat and potatoes, the real glue of this defense. I don't know about that linebacker spot, and Burfecht's suspension is a big question. When he's on the field, he's pretty good. He's just been unreliable because of the multiple suspensions, you know, the different things that have kind of held him back as a player. And, you know, I was a little surprised they didn't move on from him, but I do think that the rest of that defense is in okay shape.
Well, you said it there, too. I mean, the constant suspension. I feel like this guy is constantly being reprimanded from the league for something.
Yeah. And that's part of the reason why he went undrafted coming out of college. Talent-wise, everybody knew he could play. But there was this sense of, okay, first of all, when he does play, he's a little bit wild out there. This is when he was coming out of Arizona State. You know, he was a little bit of a rolling ball of knives out there, and he'd overrun plays and stuff. But he saw the natural ability. And then on top of that, there was the sense that, was he coachable? Was he reliable? Was he going to be an injury-prone player? Did he play too recklessly? And we've seen all that play out, you know, not only the PED suspension, but also the late hit suspension. You know, it's just kind of, you know, it goes back to, okay, now I kind of get why he was undrafted. I mean, I understand now what made him that guy 6 years ago when he came out, even though the talent was all there. So the reliability factor, I mean, if he doesn't prove himself after he comes back, you know, this is probably his final year in a Bengals uniform.
What's one thing that the Bengals fans, you think, are going to get hyped about for this upcoming season?
It's tough to say. I mean, I think their best hope is that Joe Mixon really emerges as that big play threat at running back. I mean, you saw him at Oklahoma again, and we know about his off-field issues too. It's a recurring theme with this Bengals team. They take, you know, risks on character players, that sort of thing. But you can't deny that Joe Mixon was one of the best college running backs for a couple of years at Oklahoma. I mean, he was fantastic. And other than really a couple of games last year, he looked muted. He looked hesitant. He didn't look explosive. I don't know if it was a scheme issue. I don't know if it was was he in prime shape? You know, was the blocking that bad? I mean, there are a few things that we probably need to sort out a little bit, but he never looked fully engaged last year. And again, I think only part of it is his issue and part of it is maybe the rest of the team and the coaching. So if those factors all can be solved and you have Mixon running the way he did at Oklahoma, granted he had huge holes there, but if he can find ways to be productive, we know Gio Bernard is going to catch passes too. We know there's Green and the possibility of some of the big plays on offense. That's really, I think, where this team has to come is, you know, getting back to being able to score 24, 27 points in a game. I think the defense can hold most teams to 20 or 24, but the offense has to do its share of the work too.
All right, Eric, we're going to take a quick break, and when we return, we'll head to Cleveland and discuss the Baker Mayfield experience with the Browns. Will they finally win a game this upcoming season? We'll also wrap things up with the Pittsburgh Steelers. We'll be discussing that and more when we come back. Welcome back, everyone. We are continuing our division-by-division breakdowns and talking about some of the potential for each team and where they might need improvements. And we head now, Eric, to Cleveland and the Cleveland Browns. Should we say Hollywood Browns? I mean, these guys are going to be featured in the upcoming Hard Knocks series. And, Eric, will this sort of distract this team from what they ultimately need to do, which is win a game?
Yeah, no, I don't think there's going to be any distractions. I think we're going to have a good time watching this this team. I mean, so many reasons, obviously, as you kind of teased before, Baker Mayfield and him battling Tyrod Taylor, that's going to be fun right there. You've got two kind of loose-lipped coordinators in Todd Haley and Greg Williams who will keep it very interesting. There may have to be, a censorship on these sessions here with Hard Knocks a little bit. But I just think football-wise, there's so much to get excited about with this team. I realize where we're starting from. 1-31 the last 2 years combined. They haven't performed well. We don't know if Hugh Jackson can coach. We don't know if he's holding the team back at this point. But I think there's a lot of reason to think that this team could be, just in terms of wins, one of the more improved teams in the league. I don't know if they're better than 6-10 or 7-9, but I really think you're going to see them win some games last year. They had a couple close losses. They've obviously added competition at quarterback. There's playmakers on offense. There's just a lot, even with Joe Thomas retiring, that you can kind of wrap your arms around and think is going to lead to some more production on the field.
And Eric, that was going to be my next question. I mean, can anybody really replace Joe Thomas?
Well, they're going to have to find somebody. And I guess, it starts with Sean Coleman, a kid who has, overcome a lot, to get where he's at. He's a former third round pick and, has played at right tackle. And it's a tough act to follow. They had Spencer Drango there last year. I think Coleman's going to get a shot. They drafted Austin Corbett out of Nevada. Right around the same range they took Joel Petonio a couple years ago, and Petonio's been great. If they have the same type of talent with Corbett, that's two good options right there. And they have a few other players who have at least played that spot. Chris Hubbard, they got from the Steelers. He's kind of a swing tackle. He could be their right tackle, or he could play the left side. Petonio played left tackle in college. So they really have four options. Are any of them going to play as well as Thomas? No. Can they get consistently solid play there, given the number of guys they have, maybe possibly trying out at that spot? Maybe. So I don't know that it's going to be the kind of thing that destroys a season, because at least they have some talent and some options there.
I want to circle back around to the quarterback position, because I think all eyes are really going to be on Baker Mayfield. And how much of a quarterback competition do you think there really will be there? Do you think that Mayfield will essentially start this season?
Yeah, I don't think he'll begin as the starter. I think there's a real plan in place that Tyrod Taylor is going to be the guy week one. You know, I don't know exactly how they're going to kind of navigate this. I mean, you know, Mayfield had a so-so day in OTAs the other day, and does that mean that much in the big picture? No, of course not, but he's going to have his ups and downs. He's learning a new system. He's got to get used to these receivers. So does Tyrod, for that matter. You know, he's coming in, new coordinator, new guys. He's as new as Mayfield is, really. But, you know, you kind of look at their schedule and you say they open with the Steelers. Then they've got the Saints. I mean, do you throw Mayfield in right away in that situation? I don't know. That's the question. And you start looking at the calendar, and, of course, Mayfield's got to play well and, you know, show that he's a better option than Taylor. So he'll start this season. Is it going to be after the week 10 bye? Is it going to be earlier? Is it going to be later? Do you only play him, you know, let's say they're in competition. Let's say Tyrod gets him to a 500 record or above, you know, and they're sitting there possibly vying for a wild card spot. You can't make a change at that point, I don't think. So you don't want to repeat the mistakes that the Buffalo Bills made last year, you know, going from Tyrod to Nathan Peterman. Apples and oranges aside, that's the kind of thing that can really kind of kill a season. So they have to be smart about it. If Mayfield is far and away the better option, if Tyrod struggles in camp, Mayfield shines, maybe it happens. But I wouldn't be shocked if Tyrod opens the season as a starter and at some point they have a decision to make. I think he will see the field this year. I just don't know if he's going to be a 16-game starter.
How long do you think they hold out with Jackson if for some reason they start this season without a win and it goes several games? I mean, do you think that they just continue to stay with him?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, right, if they're, you know, I don't know, 0-6, 0-7. Can you go any farther? As you approach 1-40 or whatever, I mean, is there any reason to keep him on? You know, they open up with some road games too. I think, you know, four of their first six or something like that are on the road. I mean, it's the kind of thing where you go, how much more can the fans, who've been beaten down for the better part of three decades now, can they put up with this? Can they stand the losing? And I understand you're going to still have to take a step backward before you go forward at some point. But if they don't beat the Jets in week three, let's say, if they don't, you know, can't steal a win on the road, like at Oakland, at Tampa, you know, if they're not at least competitive at home against the Steelers, the Ravens, the Chargers, you know, then you maybe consider a change. The question then becomes, who's the head coach? Is it Todd Haley? You know, is it Greg Williams? Is it Amos Jones, the special teams coordinator? Are any of the guys who take over at that point just placeholders? So, I don't know. I with John Dorsey taking over as general manager, there is this feeling that Hugh Jackson has to really, really impress this year for him to keep this job past the season.
A lot to watch down in Cleveland for sure. We wrap things up in the AFC North with the Pittsburgh Steelers. And Eric, what is the upside to this team in 2018?
Super Bowl contender. I mean, again, they have their warts and they still have to figure out some things on defense. And, you know, there's obviously the contract situation with Le'Veon Bell and all that. And will Ben Roethlisberger, you know, have some of those games like he did the regular season game against the Jaguars, you know. Along the way, he's had a few slip-ups, but he was great down the stretch. You know, he ended up torching that same Jaguars defense. It wasn't really the reason they lost, I guess, even with the early turnovers in that game. You know, I guess I'll put it this way. I'm not too worried about the offense. You know, the defense is really the unit that can take this group to a higher level. You add Morgan Burnett. You know, you bring in more help from the draft. You still have some questions at middle linebacker. They may sign a veteran, who knows, but I guess if they can consistently stop the run better than they did a year ago, they had four or five games where they were absolutely atrocious in stopping the run. Overall, their numbers were not terrible defensively last year. It's really the way that they finished. It's the last five, six games, right around the time Shazier got hurt. From there on out, we saw what the Jags did to them at home in the playoffs. You know, there were other games last year where they gave up far too many points. I mean, the Baltimore Ravens, I think, hung 38 on them at the end of last year. That says a lot. That was not a productive offense last year. They certainly looked it, though. It's just taking that defense to the next level and assuming that, you know, the killer bees on offense are going to keep doing what they do.
With the trade of Martavis Bryant to the Oakland Raiders, does that help this team? Does that hurt this team? Does that leave a hole with the wide receivers?
Yeah, good question. I mean, obviously, what he was able to provide in the past was this big play ability, this home run ability that, you know, you have Brown work in the middle. He's going to always be that guy. Smith-Schuster was a big play guy, but he wasn't a down-the-field guy. He was more of the hit the slant and, you know, get yards after the catch kind of a player. You know, tight end is just an okay group with Jesse James and Vance McDonald. So that spot, the big play position, is now gone, unless you think James Washington, the rookie, is going to step up and be that player. Now, he's a fun player to watch, and he made some big, big plays. I think if they keep things simple for him and don't ask him to do a ton, you know, he's got the long arms. He's a short guy. He's only like 5'11", but he's got the arms of a 6'3 receiver. He won a ton of 50-50 balls last year. If you watch any Oklahoma State game, it was basically Mason Rudolph, is now teammate again, throwing jump balls to James Washington downfield. If he provides that 3, 4, 5, 6 times a game, you know, even if those aren't complete, it opens up the run game, et cetera. They may not feel that loss. They may feel pretty good about their situation. You always have Darius Heyward-Bey who can run a route or two. They have Justin Hunter still. So, again, those aren't reliable, you know, things you want to sort of lean on. But I think they're going to be fine. And I think Washington's going to get a great crack at that deep receiver position they have.
What about ways of utilizing the tight end in the passing game as well?
Yeah, Vance McDonald is fascinating because he did next to nothing in the regular season. I mean, he came over from San Francisco in a trade, had to get kind of thrown in there, was a big factor on special teams, but didn't really play that much on offense, or wasn't featured as a receiver that much until the playoff game. And he caught 10 balls for 100-and-something yards. It was by far his best outing. McDonald has always been regarded as a good athlete at the position. Jesse James, you know, of course, we remember the touchdown that was called back against the Patriots. He is what he is. He's a good player. He'll catch some balls. He's not, you know, going to be – you're fine with Jesse James catching passes if you're an opposing defense. You know what I mean? You'll let him catch balls. McDonald's gives him a little more juice at that position. So another year in the program, learning the offense, et cetera. Wouldn't be stunned if Vance McDonald ends up, you know, popping some surprising plays or has two or three decent games for them. That could be a spot to watch for them.
Is there anything else fans should be looking for in the Pittsburgh Steelers for this upcoming season?
You know, nobody talks about Jalen Samuels. I know he's a fifth-round pick, and so let's not make too much of him. And Bell's obviously going to be kind of the workhorse back. But it wouldn't shock me if they kind of carved out a role for Samuels. He was a running back, a fullback, a tight end, a receiver, whatever you want to call him, that kind of, you know, joker position on offense. If they can find a role for him where he takes a little bit of the help away, you know, a little bit of the pressure off Bell, you know, can be a runner, a returner, a receiver rather, that wouldn't be a shocking development. The biggest question, of course, as I mentioned earlier, though, can they get a consistent pass rush on defense, and then solidify that secondary with Burnett, Artie Burns in another year. Mike Hilton played pretty well in the slot. Sean Davis is the big one. He's got to be a more reliable player and not just a great athlete out there who, you know, guesses wrong and makes some missed tackles out there.
Excellent stuff, Eric, and thank you for taking us through the AFC North. That'll do it for our division-by-division breakdown of the AFC North. And looking at those teams next week, we'll take a look at the AFC South, so you want to be sure and listen to that. I want to bring Hub Arkish back in, and we did this last week, Eric, and we talked about some AFC East win totals. Let's take a look at AFC North win totals. Let's start, actually, with the Browns. Think the team that everybody's asking, are they going to win a game? Right now, I believe the Browns are
5.5.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on that?
It's funny because they're not the lowest on the board. I believe the Arizona Cardinals are at 5, you know, and so you have a team that won 0 games, that only has won 1 game in the past 2 seasons, and yet you're betting that they're going to win 6 football games this year. Because you obviously, if you bet on the 5-5, you bet the over, 5 isn't getting it done. 6 games, that's a lot to ask, even though I just got done saying I thought they were going to be improved. the question is, can they win those field goal games, those close contests that they found ways to lose? You know, overtime games, miserable contests like the one Joe Thomas got hurt in last year. I think it was a 9-3 game. So I think that's the biggest thing holding me back. The talent there is fun. You know, they bring in Jarvis Landry and all these guys. They have Myles Garrett in year two, fully healthy. I 5.5 is a little frightening to me. If it was 5, I could live with the push and I'd bet the over. 5.5, we're starting to get into that gray area. So they're a fascinating team at that number.
Well, I think based on recent history, if the total is any more than 1, you got to take the under. and my prediction, if you will, is I think the Cleveland Browns are literally going to be 500% better than they were last year. Yeah. Which still says take the under. I could see 5-11. I think 4-12 is more likely. I actually am picking them to finish in third place ahead of the Bengals, who I think are going to have an awful season. Eric, I think the difference is that Tyrod Taylor, knows how to win some football games, and they are going to stick with him for a while. But I think they've got an awful head coach. I think that's the part that nobody talks about. I talked to other coaches over the course of last season, clearly off the record, which everybody will understand when they hear what I'm about to say. And the question was, if you knew absolutely nothing and you had the worst roster in the history of the NFL, couldn't you still win 2 or 3 games by accident? And every one of them said yes. And it just tells me that I just don't think Hugh Jackson's a very good football coach. I think he's got a much better roster, but I struggle to see him winning more than 4 or 5 games with it.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. And just to bring in the Bengals who you mentioned, I mean, they're sitting there at a win total in Vegas, at least, of 7. I like you, would pick the under there, too. Because obviously, if you're saying they're going to finish behind the Browns, who are at 4-12 or 5-11, we're talking about a Bengals team that's 4-12 or something like that. So, yeah, I mean, those two teams, you know, Hugh Jackson comes back. Marvin Lewis comes back. Now, I happen to think Marvin is a much better head coach than Hugh has been. But I have those same questions, too. Is Todd Haley going to make that much of a difference? Is Greg Williams a loose cannon? Do they have the special teams coordinator? And Chris Tabor goes to Chicago. You know, they bring in Amos Jones. So, I think that's a legitimate beef or a question when you're considering that win total.
Yeah, guys, Marvin Lewis is a good football coach. I don't think he should still be the coach of the Bengals. I mean, we look at the history of the whole thing, but he is a good football coach. I mean, he took a team that never goes to the playoffs and went, 6 out of 7 seasons, unfortunately couldn't win a playoff game. The coaching isn't the issue there. I don't think the Bengals roster is as good as the Browns. I actually was surprised they won as many games as they did last year. Mm-hmm. I don't see how they're really improved. And if the total is 7, I think the under on the Bengals is probably one of the best bets on the board.
I would feel safer on Bengals under 7 than I would Browns over 5.5. I agree.
How about Steelers at 10.5?
That's tough. I know they were 13-3 last year. You know, I mean, you can't argue with the results, even with the playoff loss there. That's still a big number for any other team not named New England Patriots. 10.5 is still asking a lot because I don't think the Ravens are a joke. You know, I think the Browns will maybe steal one in one of those divisional games. So I don't know. 10.5 feels... It's about where it should be, but that's not a bet I'd feel too comfortable about.
Yeah, you took the words out of my mouth with tough. That is tough. I think it's a pretty safe bet that Le'Veon Bell isn't going to show up until the day after Labor Day again, and they got away with that last year, but particularly with his injury history and some of his off-the-field stuff, you can't count on getting away with that every year. I think that they're thinking about the next generation at running back, but they're not there yet. Roethlisberger, to me, is probably one of the more underrated quarterbacks in the league, if people can buy that, but you can't ignore the problems he had on the road last year. They came and lost at Chicago, what were the Bears? I forget. 5-11, I think. 10.5 is probably the perfect number. Vegas is good at that, actually. And so I know this isn't what our folks want to hear as far as advice, but sometimes the best advice is stay away. And I would stay away from that because I expect that the Steelers are going to win 10 or 11 games, and I'm not sure which.
How about the Baltimore Ravens? The Ravens, I think, are set at 8. And I think you alluded to that earlier, Eric, that's pretty safe.
Yeah, I don't know why. I guess I'm just more positive on the Ravens than a lot of people. You know, they were a boring football team last year. They didn't have that offensive explosiveness. The defense was good, but still kind of faltered down the stretch. So I understand people's hesitation with them a little bit. But they were 9-7 on the verge of a 10-win season before that fourth quarter meltdown at the end of the year. The numbers, you know, the numbers that people around the league sort of value, such as the turnover margin and things like that, and they tend to suggest that the Ravens are a better football team than what they showed last season, especially with some close losses down the stretch at Pittsburgh and then the game against the Cincinnati Bengals, you know, 4th-and-12 fluky play. Four of the first six are on the road. I think five of the first seven are on the road. They have a tough start. They get the Steelers a couple times in the first half of the season. So, you know, hanging tough early is going to be the biggest thing. And how do they use Lamar Jackson? Because there is this suggestion that they very well could be folding him into the game plan. I would go over 8. I feel like this is a pretty good football team. I feel like John Harbaugh is feeling a little pressure, and they could result in a pretty good season. But yeah, there are questions.
Yeah, I'm going to go over on this one. Listen, the Ravens, the difference for me with them as opposed to, you know, certainly Cincinnati is I see how the Ravens got better during the offseason. I know you never want to count on rookies, but I love that draft. And with 11 or 12 of them, a couple of those kids are going to make a contribution. You know, I did love the piece you did a couple of weeks ago, Eric, about the one score losses and wins. And, you know, the Ravens are a team with a little luck, could have been better. I think John Harbaugh is an excellent football coach. I think what happened is it is probably time for Ozzy to hang him up. He has not been the Wizard of Oz the last few years, but I think he put on a pretty good finale is what it comes down to. This draft, unlike his last few, I'm very impressed by. They're never big movers and shakers one way or the other in free agency. I don't want to diss Joe Flacco too much because as much as I wouldn't want him as my starting quarterback for 16 weeks, you know, when it comes to big games and playoff time, there's nobody better, so they're solid enough there. I don't think the Ravens can win a playoff game, but I think they can make a run to get there, and you got to win 9 games to do that, so I'm going to say the over.
Yeah, I just feel like their injury luck was so bad last year, and you know, Flacco playing with a bad back the first part of the season, you know, when they started, what were they, 3-4, 4-5 before the bye? I mean, you know, that contributed to it. They started getting strong again in the second half of the season before that crazy meltdown at the end of the year, so I'm with you. I just feel like there's all the injuries they faced. I don't think they're going to have that same bad luck again. The draft, as you mentioned, was a good windfall for them. I kind of feel pretty good about that over 8 number right now.
All right, guys, that'll do it for this week's episode of the Pro Football Weekly Podcast. We want to thank you all for listening this week, and we hope that you head on over to iTunes and subscribe to this podcast if you've not already done so. A reminder, there's always great NFL news 24/7 over at ProFootballWeekly.com, so be sure to be checking that out on a regular basis. Don't forget, next week we'll be looking at the AFC South. So again, download and subscribe to the Pro Football Weekly podcast on iTunes, as well as our other podcasts, including the Pro Football Weekly Chicago podcast for those of you that are Chicago Bears fans. Want to thank you all once again for listening. Want to thank Eric Edholm for joining us today, Hub Arkish for joining us today. For those guys, I'm Dan Mott. We will talk to you next week. Take care, everyone.